I'm delighted now to welcome Avinoam Patz. He is professor of modern Jewish history at the Maurice Greenberg Center for Judaic Studies at the University of Hartford. And he will be speaking on Sunday, the 2nd of January, at Congregation Beit Tikva, sponsored by the New Mexico Jewish Historical Society. The talk is titled Jewish Youth and Zionism in the Aftermath of the Holocaust. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you will be talking about the time period in Europe, 3 years between the end of World War II and the founding of Israel in 1948. Here you have a population of Jewish Holocaust survivors displaced, traumatized. Where did they go? What did they do?
It's interesting because if you look at the period after the war, it's a population that really changes in the first 3 years after the war, really in the first year after the war. So in my book, I look at the situation in Germany immediately after the liberation of the concentration camps there. And there you have, estimates vary, but about 50,000 Jewish Holocaust survivors who are a small percentage of really millions of refugees, displaced persons, and POWs who are in Germany at the end of the war. And from that 50,000 or so who are liberated from Germany, by 1947, you have close to 200,000 Jewish survivors who have congregated in the American occupation zone of Germany, many of them coming from Eastern Europe to Germany. And by 1947, you have this very large stateless population of Jewish displaced persons who really have nowhere to go. The United States still has their restrictive immigration policy. They've decided they don't want to stay in Europe. They can't stay in Poland, where anti-Semitism persecution persists. And the state of Israel doesn't exist yet. And the British still don't want to allow refugees from Europe to come to Palestine. So you know, what I look at is sort of the options that are available to these survivors and the situation that they face and what ends up being a disproportionately large role that they play in diplomatic decisions taken after the Second World War.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's interesting because if you look at, you know, you have this relatively small population of displaced persons, you know, going from 50,000 after the war to perhaps 250,000 by 1947. And as, you know, the first year or two after the war goes on and this growing population of displaced person grows in Germany, the solution to their, you know, statelessness and the refugee situation becomes increasingly urgent. And initially, the British are reluctant to allow these survivors to come to Palestine. But as the number of survivors grows and their sort of demonstrations on behalf of Zionism and the need for the creation of the State of Israel grows, you have this remarkable situation where people who have just been liberated from camps, emerging from hiding, emerging from the Holocaust, come to play a very significant role in international diplomacy after the war, and in many ways leading to the creation of the State of Israel.
Now, there were kibbutzim in Germany and Poland at first. How did these places arise? What were they like?
So it's one of the aspects, it's actually one of the things that drew me to this topic in the first place when I discovered that there were actually operating agricultural training farms that were created in Germany and in Poland very soon after the end of the war. One of the first places that's created is a kibbutz that takes the name Kibbutz Buchenwald, and it's a kibbutz of survivors from the concentration camp of Buchenwald who decided that they couldn't live, in what remained of the concentration camp, and that they wouldn't live in a refugee camp that had been created nearby, and that they wanted to train themselves for their future lives in the land of Israel. And so these survivors who created Kibbutz Buchenwald basically took over what had been a German farm. It was requisitioned through the assistance of the American military and sympathetic GIs and Jewish chaplains with the U.S. Army. And they created a functioning farm. And this model became so successful that by the end of 1946, you have 40 farms like this operating throughout Germany, in the American zone of Germany after the war, housing thousands of young people working on these farms. And in many cases, they were fully operating farms, although the young people working on them often didn't know the first thing about agriculture. So they had to be trained how to be farmers, or often relied on the assistance of Germans who were living nearby to help them farm, who had worked on the farm before. So it's a very unusual situation that emerges in Germany after the war. But much of what happens in Germany in the first 2-3 years after the war is highly unusual. So it's par for the course.
Talk about untold stories. I mean, German farmers helping Holocaust survivors farm in 1946 through 48.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. You know, one of the farms that I write about in the book is a farm that takes the name Kibbutz Nili, which comes from an acronym from the Book of Samuel. Nili stands for Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, or the eternal strength of Israel will not be belied. And the young people who are working on this farm, it's not just any farm, it's the estate of Julius Streicher, who was one of the foremost Nazi propagandists, and actually one of the 22 Nazis put on trial at Nuremberg. And so you have to imagine that you have these young people farming his estate, taking over the buildings and working with his animals, renaming everything with Hebrew names, while nearby in Nuremberg, he is on trial and eventually executed. So it's pretty remarkable, and sort of it functions really as kind of a symbolic sort of revenge also for them to be able to take matters into their own hands and, you know, take over this estate over the war. And I think that symbolic significance is very important in these sort of, you know, diplomatic decisions that are made after the war, when international powers have to decide, well, what will be done with these survivors and refugees after the war?
The kibbutz model is a combination of a kind of collective socialism and Zionism, and I was wondering if the impulse toward collectivism was, it seems like it must have been a natural response to persecution and genocide. Did that experience of the kibbutz help people to deal with the trauma of the war and the Holocaust?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question. It does sort of, one of the things that I try to understand in the book and in my research is what is the appeal of this model for many of the young people who do join these kibbutz groups after the war. And, you know, in some cases, we deal with these, what I described for you as these agricultural farms, and in other cases, a kibbutz is used after the war to refer to sort of these collective units of somewhere between 50 and 100 young people who decide that they're going to live together, to pool their resources, to be part of a youth movement. And one of the things we have to remember is that many of the survivors are young, between the ages of 15 and 30. That's who was most likely to survive. And for many of them, they are orphaned, they're alone, they have no family left after the war. And so this model, sort of an alternative living framework that is collectivist in nature, that can provide a kind of a replacement family, is very appealing after the war. That being said, you know, the sort of ideology that the movements represent and that these kibbutz groups represent isn't necessarily what draws them into these groups. They, you know, often don't know much about the ideology of the movements they're joining. They've spent 6 years in hiding or being persecuted during the war. So it's often more sort of the pragmatic and psychological appeal of these kibbutz groups that draws them in, more than, you know, the ideology of the movement that they're joining, which they often know very little about.
There is some historical controversy about the whole question of Zionism and the impulse towards Zionism, and whether it arose naturally from the survivors themselves or was more heavily influenced by outside ideologies and organizations. Your book is called Finding Home and Homeland, and you drew on sources like diaries and letters and so on written by the survivors themselves. What did you find? How did your original source material help you flesh out some answers to those questions?
Well, as you allude to, I certainly wrote this book in response to a debate that was going on in the historical literature about Zionism amongst the survivors. You know, there were these sort of two opposing schools of thought. One that said that Zionism after the war, the desire to create a Jewish state, was a very natural and obvious conclusion to what they'd experienced after the war. And then the other school said, you know, that the Zionism was not homegrown among the survivors, but was the survivors themselves were manipulated by emissaries sent from Palestine on behalf of the Zionist movement, who were trying to use the survivors to, you know, in their effort to create the state, and looked at the survivors as sort of weak and passive after the war. And I thought that in order to answer this question, you know, there hadn't really been enough work and research that had looked at materials created by the survivors themselves to say, well, what is it that they truly wanted? Because one of the things that's remarkable about this period in time, 1945 and thereafter in the DP camps, is that there is a remarkable amount of source material created by the survivors themselves. As you allude to, there are diaries, there are letters, there are newspapers. It's a tremendously productive period of time, and so there is more than enough material to try to understand what is it the survivors saw amongst themselves. And what becomes apparent is that Zionism was most definitely a conclusion that was reached by the survivors, not something that was imposed from abroad. But as I suggest, it had an appeal that oftentimes was more pragmatic and psychological than ideological. That for the young people that I write about, the appeal that drew them into these kibbutz groups was more about, as I say in my title, sort of the quest, the looking for a home, something that would give them that sense of camaraderie and what had been lost during the war. Once they had joined these sort of alternative homes, they did become educated in the ideology of the movement. But it was a process that began first with sort of that search for looking for a home after the war that then ultimately led them to the State of Israel.
Avi Noam Pat is a professor of modern Jewish history at the Maurice Greenberg Center for Judaic Studies at the University of Hartford. And once again, he will be speaking on Sunday, the 2nd of January, at Congregation Beit Tikva, sponsored by the New Mexico Jewish Historical Society. The talk is called Jewish Youth and Zionism in the Aftermath of the Holocaust. And his book is called Finding Home and Homeland. Thank you so much, Professor Pat, for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. And by the way, I'm doing a little survey at facebook.com/radiocafe, so check it out. Give your opinions about the Santa Fe Radio Cafe at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.